On a distant island, nature holds an incredible secret.
And now it's only a matter of time before this lost world is found.
Some have come to observe its wonders. Others to hunt it down. A Steven Spielberg film.
Don't move!
The Lost World. Rated PG-13.
And welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated sequels. You know, the ones that some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello!
And I'm Claire. In this episode, we're being emotionally blackmailed by a very English-sounding Scotsman into revisiting our biggest life trauma to date, only to find a group of idiotic mercenaries have rocked up to undermine everything we're trying to do. And there's some pretty pissed-off T-Rexes to boot. Michael, what's the movie?
We're heading to Jurassic Park site B Island for more dinosaurs, for more people getting eaten by so dinosaurs, and a plot so thin you can see the finale through it like tracing paper. This is the Lost World Jurassic Park. Yay!
Yay! I've been looking forward to this one.
So I assume this will be the one of many Jurassic Park / Jurassic World sequels we will be featuring in our podcast. Because we seem to have wrapped up Superman last year and we're looking for a new franchise to do random episodes on. So I think this will be the first of many episodes to come, I would assume. So
we're going to spread them out, though, aren't we? We're not like...
Yes, we are going to
back to back. That would be a bit too much, I think. Too much dinosaur.
We're spreading them out. I think this year we're going to tackle the Jurassic Park movies and then next year we'll look at the Jurassic World sequels. So that would be
the plan.
So, The Lost World Jurassic Park opened on the 23rd of May, 1997. It went on to gross $618.6 million against a budget of $73 million, which is pretty fucking fantastic.
Oh, that's quite good.
Yeah. That's quite good. So people are like, why the fuck are you covering this? They're going to be thinking that now. But stay with us. It'll all come clear
soon. I mean,
watch
the movie.
Yeah. But budget-wise, okay, so let's just pick away at that, okay? Also, The Lost World had a $250 million marketing campaign set up by Universal, including 70 promotional partners. So the promotional budget outweighed the budget for the movie. So when you have to take that into consideration...
By three times.
Yes, not a good turnout. So just for comparison, Jurassic Park, we're going to talk about each Jurassic Park film, but we're going to just compare them to the original at the moment. And we're only going to talk about Jurassic Park in this one, in this episode, and The Lost World in this episode. We're going to worry about the other episodes as we go along. For comparison, Jurassic Park released in 1993 and went on to take $978 million against a budget of $63 million. So they've increased the budget. Lost $300 million off the bottom line of the gross. So that's a problem. Also, comparing Jurassic Park promotional budget, which was only $65 million, for some reason.
Wow.
Like they quadrupled the amount of money they're spending on promotion for this film compared to even the original movie. They thought they were going to be like, this was to take more money than the original one did. Let's get out there. Let's get people promoting. Or the studios watched a movie and went, we need to really push this so it's fucking everywhere. People can't escape looking at it. A bit like Batman and Robin. Same year as well, 1997. Let's just push advertising so people just go like zombified to the box office. Need to watch Jurassic Park, The Lost World. It's everywhere. But they had Jurassic Park had $65 million marketing campaign, which included licensing deals for about 100 companies. So less companies wanted to be involved in this movie as a sequel, what is weird. But that $250 million they used on marketing campaign, it's one of the highest marketing campaigns in Hollywood history for any movie ever out of a studio. So that's quite eye-opening. I felt that quite interesting.
Mm.
Jurassic Park has also had a couple of re-releases over the years that has now pushed the gross over $1 billion. But Lost World hasn't. The Lost World has still sat there with this one. But talking about $1 billion, let's do a quick little pop quiz just to wake Claire up, see if how her movie brain is working in the new season.
Ooh.
So, Claire, what was the first movie to take $1 billion at the box office? Not including inflation.
Not ever? Including.
Ever.
Not in, so an actual $1 billion, not...
An actual $1 billion, nothing changed for inflation, just the $1 billion. Hard cash.
Have
you seen
know.
This movie? Like, You're alive.
Titanic?
Yes,
or are we going further back?
No, Titanic. You know, you're kind of right. Okay, in that case, let's try another one. What is the first $1 billion movie adjusted by inflation? Oh, the look I'm getting, the slight look, the pop quiz eyes.
I'm wondering if this
brain.
Is a trick question, because when we talked about The Exorcist, that was one of the highest grossing movies at the time, but that's a quite a niche genre, so I can't imagine. Jaws?
Jaws, nearly, but no. The first $1 billion movie was Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, that figures.
So let's look at the worldwide box office of 1997. We have mentioned this top 10 in previous episodes.
Yes.
But I am going to go through it one more time for people that are not tuning in for just this episode. So at number 10, we have The Full Monty. Took more money everywhere else than domestically, but worldwide, it was the biggest grossing movie, number 10 movie of the year. Number 9, Fifth Element. Number 8, My Best Friend's Wedding. Number 7 is Liar Liar. Number 6, As Good as It Gets. Number 5, Air Force One. Number 4, Tomorrow Never Dies. 3 is Men in
Black. That's not how the song goes.
Doesn't it? I also thought all James Bond songs were the same. Okay, number 3 is Men in Black. Number 2 is The Lost World, Jurassic Park. We're doing a movie that's in the top 10. Number 1 is Titanic.
Is this the first time we've covered a movie that has actually been in the top 10 for its year?
Yep. I think it is.
The Lost World.
No, I think Batman Forever was in the top, but it didn't take the money this took. Yeah.
No.
I don't think it took the money, but I think it was in the top 10 worldwide.
Okay.
I think that took like 300 million, but that was early 90s. and here are some unloved sequels that came out this year that we've already covered on this podcast is Speed 2 when Batman and Robin were released that year.
Mm-hmm.
And some unloved sequels also came out that year that may be future episodes. So take note, people, if you want us to cover these, phone in, write in, whatever you need to do. There is Home Alone 3.
They're not going to phone or write, are they? Those are the only two ways you can't contact us.
You can write
me now.
You
can get us on the socials. You can email us.
Yeah, that's right. You can say right.
Okay, fine.
And you can send a voice note. That's phony, isn't it? A voice note?
How? How are they sending us voice notes?
Facebook Messenger, you can send voice notes.
Oh, don't do that. I don't listen to it. If you listen to it, if you send us a voice note, Michael might listen to it. I'm not going to. I don't even listen to Michael's voice notes unless I have to.
She's such a bitch.
Sorry, go on. You were saying something important.
Yeah, so there is a few movies that came out that year that may be future episodes. And if you want to hear about them, please let us know. We have Home Alone 3, Alien Resurrection, Free Willy 3. That's a mouthful.
That's Vegas, what she said.
I said it. The minute I said it.
Sorry, I'm very juvenile. Continue.
Vegas Vacation, American Werewolf in Paris, and Mortal Kombat Annihilation. All kind of flop. There's a list there that, you know, you might want to listen to. The Lost World Jurassic Park currently sits at 103 at the all-time sequels box office. That's quite high for the list for us, you know, 103.
Yes, by our standards, that is quite high.
That is quite high. The Lost World Jurassic Park came out on VHS in 1997. It was also accompanied by a 50 million promotional campaign.
Spent some more money on it. Haven't spent enough money on this movie yet.
Yes, fuck.
Have
sake,
more money.
They spent 300 million on just advertising for this film. For 50 million promotional campaign, just for one of the largest at home release promotional budgets ever as well. So they've At least it achieved something, you know, but yes, spent the most
it's
money.
Definitely breaking records.
Definitely breaking records and spending the most money. Just for comparison, Jurassic Park VHS sold 22 million copies in 1994 and was the fifth highest grossing VHS of all time. Oh, do you remember those days when you used to watch a movie and the VHS didn't come out for a year later and you were so excited?
I know.
To watch it. And with this film, it didn't. It came out in the same year. It came out in November and only sold 12 million copies. It wasn't even the largest grossing movie, VHS movie of that year. It was quite interesting, actually. Oh, wow. I fell into a bit of a deep dive of VHS sales just to look at what it did on home release and stuff. And still annoys me because I see it now with Disney Plus, but nearly every single year for about 20 years, the VHS best-selling VHS was something from the vault that Disney released, like Aladdin, yeah. Little Mermaid. I think that year was 101 Dalmatians. You know, it's, I was just like, the marketing, Disney Plus has killed Disney. It's very, very sad. Rotten Tomato scores, this sits at a 54% critics and 51% audience. First time, that's quite interesting, eye to eye, you know. Just for comparison, Jurassic Park is 91% critics and 91% audience.
Yeah.
So these are really weird.
Oh, it's matched on that as well.
Yeah. For a franchise.
Agreed.
There is actually only two fresh, in the whole franchise, there is only two fresh movies for critics and audience. And that is Jurassic Park and Jurassic World.
So the end of the first of each trilogy.
Yeah. Why did they spend so much money on the marketing campaign for this? And I thought, oh, maybe they released a Jurassic Park roller coaster theme park ride at Universal LA just because I thought spending loads of money to promote a movie would pay off because people want to come to the park and see it. The ride came out the year before and was doing very well. So that didn't answer my question. Yeah. I hope that gives people an idea on why we're covering this movie. And in the grand scheme of things, is it as successful as we see on paper? Because a lot of people look at this franchise and they see other movies in the franchise that have performed less than this, but they probably didn't have this promotional budget that they've spent a fortune on. Like $250 million on advertising before the film's even hit cinemas, and $50 million to sell fucking VHSs.
That's crazy money.
It's like ridiculous. It's like half of what it took. Plus, so to make the movie advertising and promotion, you're looking at nearly $400 million, and the film only took $618
million.
Mm. So is that an success?
So in those terms, it's not as successful as it seems.
100%. So Claire, do you have any behind-the-scenes stuff for us? Do I need to get comfy? Do I?
Well, look, I've tried to be restrained because, as people might expect, there is so much information. I know the last few episodes I've been a bit like, oh, well, there's not very much from the 90s because we've been doing much more niche movies. This was a very mainstream sequel. And so there's a lot of, and obviously the franchise is still running now.
Yeah.
So there is a huge amount of information to be found. There is so much trivia on this movie. I have, I think, no trivia. I think I'm just going to go through the production information for the movie. If people want to find out more, you all know where the internet is. There's loads of information out there. I could keep you going for the rest of the year just talking about random trivia for this movie, and no one wants to hear that. So, you know, get comfy, but don't fall asleep because it's not, I'm hoping it's not going to be as long as you think it might be.
I'm excited to hear.
So I'm going to start you off like I always do with our cast and creative team. We've got four cast back for this movie from the original. We've got Jeff Goldblum back as Ian Malcolm. And then, I mean, the other three parts are not much more than cameos, really. Certainly the kids are very much cameo parts. Joseph Mazzello back as Tim, Ariana Richards back as Lex. Richard Attenborough is back as John Hammond in a slightly larger than cameo part, but he's not really in the movie. He just kind of bookends it. Ian Malcolm is very much the main character of this movie now. And then the rest of our cast are all newcomers. We've got Julianne Moore in as Sarah Harding. We've got Pete Postlethwaite as Roland Tembo, Vince Vaughn as Nick Van Owen, Richard Schiff as Eddie Carr, Vanessa Chester as Kelly Curtis. And then we've got three actors who are fairly similar looking. So it is a little bit confusing when the movie first starts. But then you come to realise one of them doesn't have glasses, so he's quite distinguishable from the rest. And one of them is in fucking brown face, so he's quite distinguishable from the rest as well. So
we're discussing that. I was wondering if you were going
to
bring that
we'll
up.
Come back to that. I mean, we'll park that idea, but okay. Yes. So we've got Arliss Howard in as Peter Ludlow, who is the nephew, cousin, nobody knows, not sure anyone cares. We've got Peter Stormare as Dieter Stark. He's the guy with no glasses who gets eaten by all the little tiny dinosaurs that I will say the name of later when I get to it in my notes, because I can say it if I can read it, but I can't remember it without having it in front of me. And then we've got Harvey Jason in as RJ Sidhu. Eagle-eyed viewers of the movie will notice Harvey Jason is not Indian. We'll discuss later. Anyway, the movie is directed by Steven Spielberg, who had directed the first movie in the franchise. And our writing credits are for Michael Crichton, who wrote the source novel. And he also wrote the novel for the original movie and co-wrote the screenplay for the original movie with David Koepp, who did the screenplay on his own for this movie.
Before you move on, did you see the recent news? David Koepp is coming back to write the next Jurassic World.
Oh, is he doing the fourth Jurassic World? Yes.
There's no fourth Jurassic World. It's not a Jurassic. I don't know what they're going to call it, because Jurassic World is supposed to be clued up in that franchise.
So it's called Jurassic something. They're starting a new trilogy?
Yeah, so I think Jurassic Universe, maybe. Jurassic Universe.
Maybe.
Well, Jurassic, maybe. Universal opening up a new park called Epic Universe. So that would make sense.
Oh, I'll keep our eyes on that then. Yes. So David Koepp, yes, he's very prolific screenwriter. He also wrote Toy Soldiers, Death Becomes Her, Jurassic Park, as I mentioned. Oh, was that a gasp for Death Becomes Her?
Yes, one of my favourites.
Carlito's Way. The first Mission Impossible movie, Panic Room, Spider-Man in 2002, which is, I think, the Tobey Maguire one?
Yes, correct.
War of the Worlds, 2005, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Angels and Demons, Inferno, The Mummy, the 2017 reboot, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, if we're going to be completely honest with ourselves about his writing credits. But I think we can say he is very well established within Hollywood. Yes. As a screenwriter,
I like his early 90s work, his recent stuff in the 2000s. Yeah, not a fan. Not a fan.
And music, of course, we have John Williams back, who did the music in the first movie and is back for this one as well. In terms of production for the movie, so this story goes back all the way to around October 1989. And Steven Spielberg was in discussions with Michael Crichton about a possible screenplay that actually went on to become the TV series ER. So while those discussions were happening, Michael Crichton mentioned a novel that he was working on, which was Jurassic Park. Spielberg's ears kind of pricked up at that. And he was so interested in it that he optioned it in May 1990 for $1.5 million plus. So that was the upfront. Plus a substantial percentage of the gross. I don't know what percentage, but whatever source I was looking at, I can't remember if it was Wikipedia or if it was IMDb or if it was something else, used the word substantial percentage. So it's going to be a good chunk. This was before the book had even been published. He was still working on the book when Spielberg.
Friends in High
it.
Places. That's what that is.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Warner Brothers and Tim Burton were interested. Columbia Pictures and Richard Donner, 20th Century Fox and Joe Dante, they were all bidding for the rights. James Cameron tried to get the rights, but by the time he got on the phone, Spielberg had literally snapped them up a couple of hours before, so he just missed out. So after the success of the first Jurassic Park movie, there'd been a lot of pressure from fans. In fact, off the back of the success of the first book even, there was pressure from fans of the book for a sequel book. And Michael Crichton wasn't particularly interested in that. He'd never written a sequel novel before. He wasn't that fussed about doing it now. And then off the back of the movie adaptation, because although the movie was optioned before the book was published, obviously the movie came out long after the book had been published. So then when the movie was such a huge success, obviously Steven Spielberg was interested in it having a sequel movie.
Yeah.
So he spoke to Crichton and Koepp about ideas for a second movie, and they were going to build the production schedule around whether or not Michael Crichton was going to write the sequel novel or not.
Yes.
Spring 1995, a production team was assembled, and this was just as Crichton was finishing the second novel, which he titled The Lost World. At the same time as the novel was being developed and written, Spielberg and Koepp were developing ideas for the screenplay kind of simultaneously, which is how come the final script is much more of a departure from the source novel than in the original Jurassic Park movie. The Jurassic Park movie, the first movie that is, there are elements of the book that are missing from the movie, but I'm pretty sure that everything significant in the movie happens in the book. Apart, well, there's a few changes, but for the most part, it follows the plot of the movie, of the book. Whereas with this movie, with The Lost World, so there are some of the set piece scenes from the book are in the movie, but there are also other scenes that do not feature in the book at all, because they're ideas that Koepp and Spielberg had worked on before they even had the novel to use as source material for the script. And some of the departures in the first movie from the original novel did get carried forward into this movie. For example, John Hammond survived the first movie. He does not survive the first book.
Yes.
So that change obviously carries forward into this movie. Lewis Dodgson's role in the original novel was much more significant. Lewis Dodgson is the guy at the beginning of the first movie who is bribing Nedry. Is that his name? Lewis Dodgson is the guy who is bribing the other guy to get the embryos for him.
Yes.
Yes. And so that they, because Lewis Dodgson's role was greatly reduced in the first movie, because he was just in that one scene and then not seen or heard of again. He's not even referred to, I think, in the second movie, whereas in the second book, instead of having two InGen teams working against one another, we've got our original InGen team with Ian Malcolm and co. And then the rival team are from Dodgson's company, Biosyn. But that doesn't happen in this movie. Yeah, that doesn't happen in this movie because that character is basically forgotten because he was hardly used even in the first movie. We also see some elements from the first novel that didn't make it into the first film at all feature into the sequel. For example, the opening scene where the little girl is attacked on the beach, that happened in the first movie. And then John Hammond's death in the first movie, which was at the hands of the Proconsignathus. I told you I could say it when I could see it. That then in the second movie became Dieter Stark's death scene. So the death that John Hammond had in the first book came into the second movie and became Dieter Stark's death. They're all the little teeny tiny dinosaurs, the same ones that attack the little girl at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ideas that was mooted for the film's ending was going to be a big aerial battle with pteranodons attacking the helicopter as it tries to escape the island. And we did see the pteranodons at the very end of the movie, but when that ending got cut, I think there were going to be two big scenes with pteranodons and they both got cut and we just see them, I think, in the very closing montage now. There was also a scripted ending in which Hammond was going to die and Ian Malcolm attends the scattering of his ashes into the sea. And then the last scene was going to be Ian Malcolm using a pair of binoculars to look at the island and to see the pteranodons flying away from the island, which then got worked into the third film, that element of it. But for more than a year during production, Spielberg and Koepp had been considering having a scene that involved a dinosaur in a city. They wanted to Godzilla this movie, basically. Koepp was a bit hesitant. I think he felt like it would only work as a very short scene before it became too unbelievable. So they were a bit, shall we, shan't we? And then with a few weeks before filming began, Spielberg decided, no, we are going to do it. We're going to do the Godzilla ending and we're going to have the T-Rexes running rampage through San Diego. So he wanted to see, he was interested in the idea of having the dinosaurs attacking the mainland. Your face when I'm telling you this, you look like you're being sick in your mouth just at the thought of it.
We'll talk about it afterwards. Carry on, sorry.
He thought the audiences would enjoy it. And initially he was going to save it for the third film. And then he realized that he probably wasn't going to direct any more movies in this franchise. And he wanted to direct that sequence. So he moved it into this movie. And that's why we have that ending. That's all I have on the movie. See, short and sweet. There's loads more information. If you want to know more, go Google it. Do you want some alternative castings, though, before we start talking about the movie?
I love an alternative
casting. I haven't done this for a while.
Love it.
A few from kind of way back when in the original movie. Sean Connery was originally considered for the role of John Hammond, which at least would have made him actually Scottish.
Yes.
Rather than every half hour I go, oh, yes, he's supposed to be Scottish. I'd forgotten that because I think he did too.
But he doesn't give me the bumbling grandpa.
No.
Everything's going to be okay. He would have been like, I'd have been like, he looks evil. And he was making the Avengers
movie. Well, I think maybe he would have played it more like the John Hammond in the book, who is evil. John Hammond in the book is the bad guy. He is a capitalist bastard. He is not interested in zoology at all. It's completely about the cash. He's a much more gentle character. He's a fluffy grandpa, isn't he, in the movie?
Yeah.
But I think Sean Connery, you're right, he wouldn't have played it that way. Again, for the first movie, Jim Carrey auditioned for Ian Malcolm, which ended up being Jeff Goldblum.
Aren't you glad he didn't get the part?
Yes. Yes, I'm very... Do you know... But no, because Jim Carrey is, I've said this before, you love setting me off on this rant. Jim Carrey's a really good actor. I rate him as an actor. I just find the whole shtick
the rubber too much. Stick.
But I don't think he would have given us that in this movie. I think...
Wouldn't he?
Oh, I don't know. Let's not think about it. We got Jeff Goldblum anyway, and that makes me very happy.
Yeah. But I remember when Jurassic Park came out, and it was like, oh, the fly is in Jurassic Park. And people just called him the fly, didn't he? Jurassic Park, I think it put him on everybody's radar. But before that, it was just called him the fly. Because that's what his major movie was. Strange.
For sure. Then moving on to casting for The Lost World. Indian actor M.R. Gopakumar was originally cast as RJ, but he couldn't secure a work visa in time. So he had to withdraw from production.
So they banged the guy.
So, apparently he was one of six actors considered for the role. Art Malik was in contention for the role as well. He turned it down, though, because he considered both the part and the fee too small. And so in the end, they gave the part to Harvey Jason and just painted him brown rather than changing the ethnicity of the character, would have been a fine choice.
That character to be Indian.
No, not at all. There is a scene, a deleted scene, between him and Pete Postlethwaite's character of when they first meet. But even with that taken into account, it just kind of fleshes out their history of, because they've been working together for such a long time. And that deleted scene fleshes out that aspect of their kind of combined storyline. But even with that taken into account, you're right. There is no need for that character to be Indian. So why, when they didn't cast an Indian actor for the role, they didn't change the ethnicity of the character is beyond me.
Or they just didn't change anything. A white guy to play it, and you just keep calling him RJ. No one would know. No one would go, oh, that's an Indian name. Why is he white? But everybody went, why is that white man painted brown?
Yes, it was really weird. It's really weird. Gary Oldman was offered the role of Peter Ludlow, but he turned it down because of scheduling conflicts, and so ended up being replaced by Arliss Howard. Steven Spielberg originally approached Juliette Binoche about playing the role of Sarah Harding. So basically she replied that she would be in the movie only if she could play the dinosaur. So that didn't happen. Julia Roberts was apparently also considered for that role.
I heard that.
I can't quite see that either, but I don't know.
But that was like in our heyday of big movies, so she would have been a great...
Oh, for sure. Well, didn't you say My Best Friend's Wedding was on that top 10 list? The producers had suggested Mila Kunis for the role of Kelly, Jeff Goldblum's character's daughter, but Spielberg by that point had already chosen Vanessa Lee Chester. He had always wanted her. He saw her performance as Becky in A Little Princess in 1995. Yeah. And basically from that point on, he wanted her for that role. So, I think Mila Kunis never really stood a chance. Conversely, Vince Vaughn didn't even audition. He was just offered the part. Steven Spielberg had to go and see an early six screening of Swingers in 1996, because they needed his approval to use the Jaws theme in that movie.
Yeah.
And so off the back of having seen that, I think that, you know, he invited Vince Vaughn in for a chat and a coffee and a whatever. Like, he didn't just go, cast that man in my movie off the back of seeing Swingers. But he didn't have to do a screen test audition. He just got cast off the back of that movie, which Vince Vaughn is not, I don't know, maybe I'm just being a bit snobby because I always think of Vince Vaughn in things like The Wedding Crashers and for Christmases and kind of slightly silly movies. He doesn't strike me as the kind of actor that a director would see in a movie and go, I need that man for my movie. But maybe I'm just being
I really like him as Norman Bates in the Psycho remake, though. I always think of that when I think of Vince Vaughn.
I see. How did you find the movie? Tell us your history, Michael, with this movie.
So Jurassic Park is one of my top 10 movies of all time. I think it's an amazing piece of cinema, and I feel honored that I was alive when this movie came out. You know, I feel like there's not many times you go to a movie theater and you go, I'm glad I got to see it released, because there's films like Jaws or things like Gone with the Wind that I was like, I wasn't around. I never saw that with a big audience, and you know, and I never experienced that in movies, that movie, historical piece of movie history. But with this, I did. And I remember going to see it when I was 12 and stuff. So I was quite keen to watch the sequel when it came out when I was 16. Yeah. I just think it's a waste of a great cast. That's my problem with it. Uh-huh. I think the cast is great. I think there is no freaking character development. Yeah. No one gets from A to B. The only person in the whole movie that actually develops and has very little screen time is Pete Postlethwaite's character.
Yes.
Everybody else, their opinions don't change throughout the whole frigging thing. No one regrets anything.
Arguably John Hammond, maybe.
But not the sequel, because John Hammond, in the sequel...
I suppose, by the time the second movie starts, he's already kind of changed his viewpoint anyway, hasn't he?
Yeah, but the first movie, there's loads of character development.
Yeah.
They all go for character development. Like, even every single character in the first movie has a character that they all go on a separate journey on how they feel about these things. Even like Laura Dern, she's really excited, first of all, by the concept of it and then regrets it. And like Jeff Goldblum just goes, I'm right. Yeah, life did find a way. I just think the cast is fantastic in this. None of them go anywhere.
Mm.
Nothing happens with any of the cast. It just feels like I feel like this movie is just like a filler to get us to the Lost World, so that we knew where the dinosaurs came from for the Lost World. We knew where the dinosaurs came from for Jurassic World. Because all the dinosaurs in Jurassic World came from this island. They moved the dinosaurs from that island to the Lost World Island. So to me, this is the reason why this exists. It's to introduce us to a new island that the dinosaurs are flourishing in. They haven't died. They've coped on their own.
Yeah. And
that's the only reason for this film to exist. But when they made this movie, they had no reason we would get to where we are today in the franchise.
No.
So I have a real trouble watching this movie and going, yeah, there's some great scenes. I love the T-Rex stuff, like when they're going up the caravans and stuff dealing with all that. But when you've got such an iconic first movie when every character goes on a journey, and in this movie, they don't go on a journey. Jeff Goldblum spends another 2.5 hours going, told you I was right.
Yeah, but that's why we love him.
Yeah, but it doesn't develop anything. Nothing changes. You're right. It doesn't, like, you know, Julianne Moore's character. She goes there knowing what happened to Jeff Goldblum's character in the first film, but she goes there because she wants to preserve the dinosaurs. Her opinion doesn't change. She still just wants to preserve the dinosaurs. The bad guy that wants to open up the park in San Diego, at the end of it, climbs in the freaking ship with the T-Rex because he's still trying to capture the baby T-Rex after just watching what's happened on both the island and in San Diego. And I'm just like, why does this film exist? It's just a cash grab. And that really upsets me when it comes to talking about Spielberg's catalogue of movies, because there's very little films that you can look at him and go, this is a cash grab. He's a storyteller. And there's no story here. There's no arc here. Like, Free doesn't even lead into this.
Yeah.
It's a very, very complicated love story for me with this franchise, because I love this franchise and I really have a hard time with this movie, because I just think, like, it's beautiful. It's shot beautifully. The special effects, something that still hold up today.
Mm.
something got lost in translation when they were writing the script and the book was being written and what they were trying to get on stage and trying to get on location. And I just feel like it's a bit of a hot mess, really. Because I don't know. I don't even know how to express how I feel about it. Because I don't hate this movie. I just don't understand. I just don't understand why. Why it exists. You know, it doesn't. It's just more dinosaurs eating more people. But in the first movie, the people that they at, you kind of like were like shocked and scared because you had a connection with those people. They had a, each person that got eaten, they were got eaten for a reason, or there was they were doing something for their character arc. People in this film just got eaten because the only one that got eaten heroic, like you were like, oh my god, that's really bad, was with the guy that was trying to save the other Vince Vaughn.
Eddie felt bad for him.
Yeah, but everybody else, you didn't even find out that they got eaten. You're just like, oh.
But he did leave the child. That was the only justification. Because in the first movie, like you say, in the first movie, all of the deaths are very... it's almost like Shakespearean tragedy that, that the character has to do something wrong and then you see them die.
Yeah.
And in this one... Yeah, that was the first on-screen death, wasn't it? Was Eddie. And I was a bit like, ooh, that's harsh because he's a good guy. He's one of the good guys. Yeah. And I was like, so are they trying to square it away because he's left Kelly up in the little tree nest thing that he built? But even then, like, he left her there for good reasons. It's not like in the first movie where the guy ran away and left the kids in the car to run away from the T-Rex. That was him being a coward. Whereas in this movie, Eddie left Kelly... for her own safety, because he knew that he was going into danger.
Yeah, and also to help three other characters.
It seemed much more indiscriminate, the killing in this movie. And of course, most of the people that get killed are just kind of generic mercenaries who we don't even see their faces, let alone give a crap about who they really are. Yeah, it's an interesting take. I agree with you in terms of the impact of the first movie. I mean, it was just, it was a phenomenon, wasn't it? I remember I was, I'm just older than you. So I was 13 when this movie came out. It's one of the few, like, you know, I've said this before, I wasn't really much into going to the movies when I was in my teens, but this is a movie that I went to see at the cinema. I think most people our age went to see this movie at the cinema, even if they didn't see it to start with. We all just heard about how amazing it was. And watching it, rewatching it for this, it's still breathtaking. That first moment when you see the dinosaurs in that big long shot, you remember exactly how you felt watching it on that screen for the first time. And nothing that has come since compares. I had my husband and I were talking about it because we have small children. We watch a lot of dinosaur shows. And there was a series on BBC, I don't know if it made it over to America or not, Walking with Dinosaurs, that kind of came in, I think, the early 2000s or the maybe the early 2010s, that was, and for a TV show, the effects were fantastic. It was, you know, CGI dinosaurs. And I didn't actually watch Walking with Dinosaurs, but they reused a lot of the footage for a kid's version of it, I guess. On CBeebies that I have watched a lot with my small children. And the way that it's done is fantastic, but it just, it's not a patch on what they did in 1993 for Jurassic Park.
Of course not.
And of course they had a huge amount more money to plow into it than the BBC had. But you think about the amount of time that passed, it's, you know, 10, 15, 20 years later, and it's still not a patch on what they were doing in 1993. It looks so real. And like you say, like, kids now wouldn't be as amazed by that because they're so used to seeing all the CGI dinosaurs and CGI everything on everything. So, yeah, it was really impactful. I said to my husband, I feel like Jurassic Park was like our generation's Jaws.
Yeah, 100%. Yes.
It's that kind of level of groundbreaking movie making.
So does that, have you shown your child Jurassic Park?
No. No. So we watched, I got the box set out because I have the DVD Blu-ray box set, in fact, and I put it out on the side because we were going to watch it. And my son was like, oh, what are these movies? And I looked and they're PGs. And I thought, they're PGs, but I don't remember them being the kind of movie that I would show my kid. who's now 9. Yeah. So I was 13 when I saw it. You were 12. It was a PG. It's still a PG. And well, actually, technically, it's not a PG because it had a re-release last year and it got upgraded to a 12A for that re-release.
Oh, did it?
Oh. Yeah, because I did some Googling because I was like, how is this movie a PG? Was it one of those that was a 12 in the cinema? Because there was a period in the early 90s where 12 certificate existed in the UK for cinema movies, but not for home movies.
Yes.
So it would be a 12 in the cinema. And then if it was really bad, it would get bumped up to a 15 for the VHS release. Or they'd make a few cuts and they'd downgrade it to a PG. So I wondered if it was one of those movies, but no, it was always a PG until, this one re-release last year. I don't know if it's been re-edited or if they've just reclassified it anyway. But we sat down to watch it, me and my husband, and very early on, I mean, just in that opening scene, you can't see what happens, but you know what happens, and it's going to be scary for a kid. I'm still amazed that this movie is PG, and also The Lost World, because The Lost World is a lot bloodier.
This was one of the first movies. It was allowed in the UK. I remember in the UK it got a PG, but it was a PG with a heavy warning.
Yes.
It got a heavy warning saying include, and they didn't usually do that, and for this movie they did. Probably because somebody and also in America it got a heavy warning. Probably because people at the studio were giving backhanders of money to the board of films going, we want to get the
pass it on a family.
But
no, I absolutely.
There was no 12A back then. It was just a 12. So you had to be 12.
Oh, yeah. To be 12. Whereas now, we have 12A. So I could take my 9-year-old to watch a 12A.
Yeah.
But when we were that age, or when we were, I think we were about 10 when 12s first came out.
Yeah. Over here, we had to be 12. It was.
Yeah. And is that the same? Can a grown up take a younger kid?
Yeah, as long as the person that's accompanying them is over the age of 13, then you can take a younger kid with you.
Yeah, so that's similar to our 12A.
Go with your mates if you're under 13.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. But yeah, no, I certainly wouldn't show either of these movies to my 9-year-old. I mean, he's a gentle little lad. Maybe other 9-year-olds would be okay with it, but mine certainly wouldn't. I'm not sure if I saw The Lost World when it first came out in the cinema. I think maybe my enthusiasm for the franchise had kind of waned a bit by then. Or maybe I saw it and forgot it. Certainly when I watched it for this conversation, I didn't feel like I'd seen it before. So I either hadn't seen it before or I've watched it and forgotten it. I was certainly watching it with fresh eyes this time. I don't think I mind it as much as you do. I appreciate absolutely everything you said, and I don't think I disagree. Yeah. About anything. I particularly feel bad for Julianne Moore's character. I think she's very wet.
She's a fantastic actress.
Compare her to Laura Dern's character. Exactly.
100%. Exactly. And she's the only female lead in it. There's no other female characters in the film.
Yeah. Well, her and the daughter, but the daughter is very much a secondary.
Yeah. And it's the same in the first film, but at least they gave Laura Dern some balls. Julianne Moore was just like, she's like,
she talks a good talk, but then you're like, but why, why are you trying to touch, leave no blade of grass crumpled, and then she's trying to stroke a stegosaurus.
Yeah.
And, we need to be really careful, that we've invited the T-Rex into this part of the island now, this is their territory, and then spends the rest of the movie running around smelling of baby T-Rex blood because she doesn't think to take off her shirt.
Her pants and shorts.
That the baby bled onto. She's nowhere near the character that Laura Dern had in the first movie, and that's a real shame.
I would like them to bring Julianne Moore back to the franchise and let her sink her teeth into a thicker storyline. Because even with the last Jurassic World movie, they brought in the Laura Dern, Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum. So the whole franchise of the Jurassic Park movies, the first three anyway, the women are not very well, they're not equally painted. They're either kind of like a little bit wet or, Laura Dern was great, but she couldn't be a career focused woman. She was like, I want a baby. And that used to wind me up in Jurassic Park. I'm like, why are we discussing you want a kid in this movie?
Yeah.
And in the sequel, this other woman's just like...
And in fairness, that was one thing I did like in this movie in The Lost World was that although Sarah and Ian are established as a couple in this movie, you wouldn't really know it.
No.
The only reason they're a couple is because he needs that emotional blackmail to get Ian Malcolm to the island.
Yeah.
It needs to be someone he cares about. She is. She's a MacGuffin.
That's the word. She's Jeff Goldblum's MacGuffin.
She is. But I like that. But I like that we don't end the movie with them having a big smooch and it's okay because they're in love. Because that's not what this movie is about. This is not a love story. This is, you know. So I like that they didn't do that. And although we said that the female characters are a little bit weak, arguably Kelly is a better written female character than Sarah, I think, the daughter, although she has less to do, in inverted commas, I think she's probably a better written character. I like that they don't get damseled all the time, which is quite nice. Jeff Goldblum spends the whole movie rocking up to try and save them and they're like, no, we've got this. Actually,
we don't need you. Yeah,
we don't. And she even does it. She has a whole speech about it, doesn't she? Of, you know, if you want to save me from dinner with your parents, save me from, you know, all those crappy things that we do as a couple at home. Don't save me from dinosaurs because I've got that covered. So I quite like that aspect of it. I actually found myself thinking back a lot to our Jaws 2 conversation. Yeah. I think because I'd got this thing in my head of, you know, this is our generation's Jaws movie. And I do wonder if there is an element, and I'm not saying this is as good a movie as Jaws 2, but I think there is an element of, like we said with Jaws 2, it can't compare to the first movie. And actually, maybe in isolation, it might be a better movie. If the first one hadn't existed, the second one might be more appreciated. But because the first one is so good, you watch the second one and you're not going to be satisfied because it can't be as good as the first, because you can't see the dinosaurs for the first time. You can't, you know, there's so much in that first movie that was groundbreaking and you can't re-break that ground.
But at least with Jaws 2, it had a different director. It had massive issues in production that they overcome.
And
it tells a different story.
For sure. This doesn't. Yes. Yes,
we
there's much more change between the two Jaws movies than there are between
the lead character. There's massive changes even with Chief Brody between Jaws and Jaws 2.
Yeah.
You know, there's massive character development between them two movies with that character. There's no character development in this film whatsoever. The minute they're doing the Zoom meeting or the Skype meeting from the island with the investors going, John Hammond wanted to bring before he started seeing Jurassic Park. He built half a stadium in San Diego that no one's mentioned before. And we're like, and we're going to end up in San Diego at the end of this movie.
Yes.
You knew where you were going. There was no thing. There was no surprise turn. You know, Pete Postlethwaite was going to go and, you know, Pete Postlethwaite to me had the biggest character arc in this movie and they didn't use him enough. I thought it was a great character. I'd rather have watched a movie about him trying to hunt the T-Rex and watch what we watched, you know. It was such, I don't think it feels like a wasted opportunity. One thing I do like about this movie is, and I just want to touch on it based, is John Williams' score.
Yeah.
And I think he knows how to take something that he's done before and give it a new lick of paint. What did you think about that score?
I think, I challenge you to find me a John Williams score I don't love. I've never come across one. And actually, I know from my research that he made a very conscious decision to revamp everything that he'd written from the first movie. He didn't use a lot of the themes from the first movie, didn't get used in the second movie. Obviously, like the main theme. Yeah, I think it's a brilliant score. I think it's great that he took the opportunity to put in some new scoring. And there were bits of it that sounded quite Star Warsy to me.
Yeah,
it was much more epic soundtrack, I think, even than the first movie.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's such a shame that the score doesn't match the movie that is being put in.
Yeah, you know, the movie is not more epic than
the first one. Did you like the finale? Did you like the way they took it to the back to suburbia and San Diego, or do you think it just didn't match what was going on? I felt like it was just quite a heavy slap across the face, and then they like
I feel like
the whole Godzilla
the movie ended, and then they put the ending on.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like it. I don't mind it. I thought it was slightly ridiculous because who the hell thinks that this is going to be a reasonable idea? Yes, let's bring a T-Rex to San Diego. What could possibly go wrong? Well, yeah, everything. And then that's what inevitably happens. It's very predictable. Yeah, I think it's an unnecessary ending. Yeah.
Did it annoy you that Vince Vaughn's character suddenly just disappeared after the helicopter ride?
He's just gone.
He's so involved and suddenly he goes, oh, I've clocked off now. I'm going to go home and have a cup of tea. You go to San Diego and deal with this, shall we? And he's on the helicopter when they realise what's going on.
Mm.
Like, they got back and obviously Jeff Goldblum and Julianne Moore were off to go to bloody the port to go there. But he's just like, ta-ra, love. Have a lovely day. I've had done my time.
It does feel like a last minute addition, and I guess it was. Yeah. If it was brought in with only a few weeks to go before shoot, I mean, it almost feels like they went back and redid it.
Yeah,
I don't think that's necessarily what happened, but it feels like a reshoot. And they went, well, let's just get back the people we need to get back, and everyone else can be extras because it's San Diego. It's a completely different scenes, like completely different settings. So we don't need the same actors that we had before.
The film, with the lack of character development and the lack of storyline, this film to me is about 20 minutes too long.
Yeah, they could have just not had that scene and just killed off that one character whose name I forget because I'm terrible at remembering character names. But you know who I mean, the nephew's character.
They could have
just found a way of killing him off on the island or, you know, as part of his attempt to escape from the island with the others. And that could have been the end of the movie. Or, you know, if they wanted to set up a third installment, they could have gone with that original ending of having Jeff Goldblum looking at the island and seeing the pterodons flying away. I didn't mind it in isolation as a thing. I just don't feel it was necessary for this movie. And it made the movie, like you say, longer than it needed to be. It just felt like it was tacked on to the end. It didn't feel like it was part of the movie.
Plus, it's too short. If you're going to do it properly. It just feels like it's been shoehorned in. It's not enough time for it.
Yeah.
Like, if within that scene, he comes up, it's like 10 minutes, and you expect there to be army turn up and, you know, trying to deal with all of it and just kind of like plans of the dinosaurs and the dinosaurs trampling across San Diego. You would think that, but none of that happened. It was just kind of and like a war room and stuff, but it just like he got out, they went and got the baby. They left for the baby, it chased the baby, they got back on the boat.
Yeah.
It just seemed like you had whiplash from it. I was like, what's going on? Why is this necessary?
Either make it a Godzilla movie or don't do it.
Exactly.
The one thing that I didn't like as much in this film, and I don't know how they could have done it differently, because like I say, once you've had that moment in the first movie of seeing the dinosaurs for the first time, you can't recreate that moment. And again, I guess it's a bit like the Jaws 2 thing. Like, once you've shown us the monster, you have to use the monster in the sequel. Yeah. So there is a lot more dinosaur. The dinosaurs, look, don't get me wrong, they still look great. They still look better than that BBC series and all the things that have come since with the CGI. But it's not as good as in the first movie. I think there's only like 15 minutes of dinosaur in that whole 2 hours, 10, 15 minutes of movie.
Yeah.
And that works because you know, they get the threat across so much with audio effects and with, you know, the puddles rippling and it's so much more effective. It's the monster that you can't see. And then once you've seen it by the end of the movie, I guess we have to be able to see it again in this movie because otherwise it is just a rehash. But I think one of the most effective moments in the second movie is the moment when you see the ripples in the puddles and you hear the T-Rex sound from the first movie. Mm. And, you know, when it has that shot of Jeff Goldblum when he realises what's happening. And no one else knows because they haven't seen it before. And we know because we've heard that noise before and we have that same moment that he has. And I think that was one of the most effective dinosaur moments for me in the movie, was not being able to see the dinosaur. But I understand why we had to see them, but I feel like the more you see, the more fake it becomes, much like with Jaws.
Yeah, I agree.
And I also found that the gymnastics scene a little bit weird.
Everybody finds the gymnastics scene.
It was a bit like, why is this here? Like, I see why it's here, because they're trying to show that she is a capable young woman. And
purpose. That's what it is. Yes. Right? It's a purpose of why she's there. And she's, you know, they need to give her big, like in the first movie when the sister, they have the kitchen scene and the sister kind of saves the brother and kind of outsmarts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Tyrannosaurus Rex. Not sure, the Flotoraptors.
The raptors.
Yeah, and this is the same thing in this. She's there, and then he goes, they cut you from the team, and you're like, everything they say in this movie, it comes back. Like, what do you mean you got cut?
So, well, and there was a lot of foreshadowing in the first movie as well, but yeah, it's like getting slapped in the face with a bag of bricks, that moment. Because it's just like, I love that they've given her this kick-ass scene, but it, at no point through the movie, other than that conversation at the beginning, have we seen her display that level of physical skill.
Yeah.
No, and then she suddenly just starts doing like flips and spins and all sorts around the beams of the building and kicking dinosaurs in the face. And it was a bit like, this was like Chekhov's skill or something. Yeah. I don't know. It was weird. It felt a bit weird. And then we just stopped the movie for a couple of minutes to watch her do some gymnastics. And then we carried on with the move. Do you know what I mean? It felt weird with the pacing.
Though I do enjoy, like, when the dinosaurs pop up on screen in this movie, I go, oh, dinosaurs. Watch the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are gone. Oh, dinosaurs. Watch the dinosaurs. I like all the dinosaur scenes.
This is how I feel about Jeff Goldblum in this movie.
Oh, Jeff Goldblum. Watch Jeff Goldblum.
Watch him for a bit. Lovely. Thank you very much. Oh, he's gone.
He's pretty hot in this film. Even I was like, he was quite hot in this movie.
He's just, you know, it's Jeff Goldblum as Jeff Goldblum in every movie Jeff Goldblum is ever in.
Yeah.
But no, he does definitely. That really well, is the thing. And you know.
He does Jeff Goldblum well.
If that's not what you want, then you're not hiring Jeff Goldblum, are you? But yeah, he's very charismatic.
Yeah, I always wondered.
And that's why it works.
I always wondered how they got from watching the first movie and going, right, out of all these characters, which one should we use for the sequel? The one that's laid up with his bad legs.
The sexy one?
Yeah, but is he sexy? He's hot in here, but he doesn't sell tickets, though, does he?
I don't know. It might get the mums in. That's true. And maybe some of the dads.
Yeah, no, I don't know. But I didn't get the mums in.
But they didn't give him a shirtless scene like they did in the first. That was very gratuitous.
Yeah,
in the first movie. I've fallen over and hurt my leg, and now my shirt buttons have all come off.
I got nearly eaten by a dinosaur, but I'm perfectly fine apart from my leg, and all the buttons fell off my shirt.
Yeah. There's been some serious button damage here, but but if you'd like to see my chest, it's very nice.
So, Claire.
Yes.
What would you give The Lost World Jurassic Park? Out of 5. How many T-Rexes? Should we do T-Rexes this week?
T-Rexes? Despite having slagged it off quite a lot, I did enjoy watching it. There are bits in it I didn't rate as much, and it's nowhere near as good as the first movie, but I enjoyed watching it. And on that basis, I will give it 3 grown-up T-Rexes and a little half-baby T-Rex, 3.5.
3.5 T-Rexes.
I think it's a decent watch. We've seen far worse movies in the name of this podcast than this. Yes. But it's not as good as the original, and it couldn't possibly be. How about you?
So, for me, it's not a bad movie. It's one of those weird sequels. To me, a good sequel is a movie that you can pop on and watch without seeing the other movies. It can't be digested without the other film. You have to enjoy the first movie to get to this movie. It's quite heavily linked. I like it. It's enjoyable. I'm disappointed. I'm just disappointed in it compared to the other ones in the franchise.
Mm.
And it's not a badly made film. It's not a badly acted movie. It has great special effects. You can see the team behind it really, really wants to make an entertaining movie.
Mm.
But to me, to make a movie move, you need story and you need arc, and this characters, and this just lacks all of that. So taking that into all into consideration, I would give it 3 T-Rexes out of 5.
Okay. So we've both gone higher than Rotten Tomatoes. By
yeah, like it's not a bad movie. And I think this is why one of the reasons we do this podcast is because when you look at Rotten Tomato scores, they are not fair. And people go and write reviews when they're angry and disappointed and say the film is shit, when disappointment and a bad movie are very different things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is not a bad movie. It's a disappointing movie compared to the first movie.
We're not angry, Steven Spielberg. We're just disappointed.
Now we sound like those parents. Why does that always... It's like telling a kid that they're naughty and they'll just go away. And the second you go, I'm disappointed in you. They go, oh, that's worse than being angry.
I use that on my kids. I don't tell them I'm disappointed, but I do an awful lot of, you're not in trouble here. We're just having a conversation and you need to understand what's gone wrong.
It's just what you say to Steven Spielberg if you ever meet him. Not having a conversation yeah. here. I just think
you're not in trouble, Steven Spielberg, but we need to have a conversation about Jurassic Park 2.
Yes. What went wrong?
Maybe there's some learning experiences that we can get from this and, you know,
yes.
opportunities for personal growth.
Yeah, like if you just look at his story arc and then you've got random things like this and Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, they just...
Yeah, really... but I think it's also worth factoring in as well. When he made this movie, this was his first sequel as a director outside of the Indiana Jones franchise.
Yeah, no, I know. It's
maybe
it's,
it shows.
And he's just and he was is it Jurassic Park and then Schindler's List and then The Lost World?
Yes.
So that's quite a, to go from Schindler's List and then back to the Jurassic World franchise, Jurassic Park franchise.
Yeah.
That must
have
been quite a head fuck.
Yeah.
A big head fuck.
Yes.
So
that's The Lost World Jurassic Park for you. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of the movie. You can leave us a comment. You can email us on unlovedsequels@gmail.com and you can find us on all the socials at unlovedsequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And from me, Claire.
Take care, guys. Bye.
Oh, you're breaking our hearts. Saddle up. Let's get this movable feast underway.